This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, February 3rd, 2012. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Support for KUAF comes from Theater Squared, continuing Season 6 with Tigers Be Still, February 9th through March 4th, at Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studios. The dark comedy features Sherry Wickman, underemployed and home after college, with a half-drunk sister, recluse mother, and a tiger on the loose. Tickets and more information for Tigers Be Still are available at theater2.org or 443-5600.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we spend some time with a member of Time for Three, a musical trio who will perform at the Walton Arts Center this evening. Also, we found out what happens when you create a small library in your own front yard. And our resident math professor, Haim Goodman Strauss, checks in with a new puzzle for your weekend.
It has been a mild winter in northwest Arkansas, especially when you compare it to the last few years when the area experienced a large amount of snowfall, as well as a memorable ice storm that left many stranded and without power for days, and for some, weeks. In the event of another brutal attack by Mother Nature, engineering researchers at the University of Arkansas are developing an emergency communications network that will maintain operation during natural disasters and provide critical warnings and geographic information to people affected by the disasters. Yesterday, I visited the U of A and spoke with Nilanjan Banerjee, Pat Parkerson, and Jack Cothran, three researchers involved with the project, about what inspired them to create this network.
So it's essentially the snowstorm that hit Fayetteville when I came in. A year before I came in. And there was no electricity, there was no power.
You mean the ice storm?
The ice storm, sorry. And essentially what we did was we thought about doing something about it. Like, people didn't have any access to information, totally, like, disconnected from the world. So this emergency net that we are building in such scenarios would provide GIS information to users.
Well, there are some emergency network systems already, so how is this one different? How will it benefit people?
So essentially, most of the emergency networks that are out there, they're not self-sustainable. So in most cases, what happens is the emergency personnel go out with these big devices, try to either figure out if there are survivors or not, or send information to them. Or they have satellite radios for that. Our system is such that it can be deployed solar-powered, self-sustainable. And even if you have a smartphone, you can download that information from the mesh onto your smartphone. So very different from what's out there.
And how does the solar energy work? How does that make it? How does it power it?
Well, you have a solar panel, and you harvest energy from the sunlight and store it into a battery, and you just keep it there until you need it, and the battery is what's used to power the system. But we do have to keep track of how much power we have and how much power various tasks will require, so we can allocate the task to whichever node is available.
And you mentioned mesh. What is that?
Mesh is a set of connected nodes. So one of the biggest problems in an emergency scenario is certain nodes might die, right? And if you want to cover an area with the same information, which basically moves through the area, you need connected nodes. And mesh is essentially a bunch of connected nodes covering a large area.
And how long have you guys been working on this project?
We've been working about a little over a year and a half. It's a 3-year project, so we're a little over halfway through, and we're working in development right now, developing the hardware and the software that goes with it, and we'll begin deploying it in about 6 months.
And did you guys get any sort of grant to help with the research, or?
Yes, the work is funded, almost entirely by the National Science Foundation.
And how will you be able to get this information out to people? Because if the idea is that, you know, it's because the grid has gone down and people can't watch their TVs or they can't plug in their radios, so how are you going to get this information to them? Because they probably don't have solar energy.
That's a good question. I think the idea would be that the city would want to advertise, if it were an operational system, that it would be advertised beforehand so that people would know that it was in existence. And there would probably be tests, like the emergency broadcast system. They might test the dynamic solar power dynamic mesh, for example. And people could simply take out their phones and see. The other thing is that because it's transmitting during an emergency, if people were to take out their smartphone and look for a signal of some kind, they would automatically pick up the wireless transmission that was coming out, so they wouldn't even have to know about it necessarily if they were in range of the mesh.
And what would the range be, or do you guys know yet?
So we don't really know that yet. We have to do some experiments on that, but the radios that we are using is essentially the Wi-Fi radios that you have on your laptops. So the range would be similar to what you have inside your house, for example. You open up your laptop, see your access point inside your house. So that would be about the range that we'll have on our system too. The range can be improved by using external antennas if you want, but that increases the power consumption also. So we have to have a balance there.
And it's obviously still in development. So what are some of the, kinks or goals that you need to finish before you can kind of get this out there for the public?
Well, I guess one of the things we had to do is to become familiar with all these new integrated circuits that are out there and how to apply them to various components in our system. It's almost like a cat chasing its tail because the technology comes out so quickly, you have to keep up with it. But some of the things we had to have breakthroughs are, for instance, what Alex did, being able to use the very low power transceiver to detect Wi-Fi so we don't waste energy. I thought that was very useful. And finding a way to make the circuits to where they do not require maintenance. Because the objective is for this to require zero maintenance and be self-sustainable. So, for instance, a mesh node about half the size of a book may be placed out on a telephone pole. And, of course, there's an array of them. And 10 years later, there may be an emergency, and the users come out there and they find this Wi-Fi connection. But it should be zero maintenance, and that's in low power.
And then there's the information that you're trying to deliver to the people. We want it to look as much like a modern mapping experience as you might see when under normal conditions. But all of the software that's developed to provide that kind of experience is developed and compiled for larger computers and servers and workstations, desktop machines. And to get it to run on this small, low-powered device was still a major challenge, trying to understand how we can optimize the software so that it requires less power to provide a certain level of information is really where we're focusing right now. And that's relatively new. I don't think there's been a lot of research into that.
So I'll add one more thing to it. So essentially when you deploy these things, I was talking about this mesh which is connected, right? So the placement of the nodes is also a big deal because there is terrain, there is vegetation, which actually attenuates radio signals. So to make sure that they are placed at the right place and there is sufficient redundancy so that if one node dies or is under snow or whatever, we still have this functional mesh. So these things have to be sorted out.
So is this something that would be expensive to install?
So this would be installed probably by the city. For instance, this would not be installed by individuals. And each node, we are using some commercial off-the-shelf platforms for this at this point. So the cost might be slightly higher, but it will be way cheaper than, say, a laptop. We are looking at an overall price of maybe around $400 at this point.
Or less.
But these are off-the-shelf, so that's why they are it's a little expensive. But if we build them from scratch at some point in the future, they will be cheaper.
So how close is this to something that people could see in their town?
Our goal is by the end of this year to have a deployment in downtown Fayetteville of about 30 to 40 nodes to test it out first. And at that point, I think mostly our students would be using it. We'll test it out, see it's working or not, then again do a bunch of iterations. If it works in the first round, we'll probably have it out for some common use maybe at the end of this year even. So.
And so that's something we could see here in Fayetteville?
That's the idea, yeah. Downtown Fayetteville, yes.
Is this something that you're looking to expand to other places as well?
Absolutely. So it's limited by funding at this point. So we have to buy the hardware, pay our students. We don't have a large number of students at this point. If we get more funding, our goal is to actually have it deployed across Arkansas.
Is there any similar research like this being done, do you know?
There is a lot of research on solar-powered systems, and basically sensor networks which are powered by solar and so on and so forth. People have done this for, habitat monitoring, wildlife tracking. But emergency relief, not so many. But these are exactly due to the challenges that Pat and Jack just pointed out. It's so difficult to write software for such a small system. It's so difficult to extract juice from the system, from these small solar panels. Hopefully we'll be the first time that somebody is working in parallel, I guess.
So what are you guys hoping to accomplish once this is all done? What are you hoping that it will, how it will benefit people?
Save people's lives.
Yeah, hopefully it will never be needed, though. It's like a first aid kit. You hope you never need it, but it's good to have it there.
There's another advantage of this. Like, even in a non-emergency scenario, this could be useful. For example, sending out alerts. If you are in downtown Fayetteville and you want to get an alert about something like a fire, the fire department can program this mesh and send out the alert. So it's not really just focused on emergency. It could be used for non-emergency scenarios also.
Nilanjan Banerjee, Pat Parkerson, and Jack Cothran are University of Arkansas researchers involved with developing a new emergency communications network, and I spoke to them about the project yesterday. During the interview, the researchers also expressed gratitude for all of their students who are helping with the project. This is Ozarks at Large.
Earth, sky.
What makes it so tough to stick to a diet? It might be the activity of certain neurons in the brain that eat themselves.
That's according to a report in the August 2011 issue of the journal Cell Metabolism. Researchers at New York's Albert Einstein College of Medicine say that when we don't eat, hunger-causing neurons or nerve cells in the brain start munching on themselves, and that in turn can trigger excessive hunger.
The team examined the brains of fasting mice and saw this happening in the neurons inside their brain's hypothalamus. The self-cannibalizing action of the neurons triggered a cascade of chemical reactions inside the mice brains that created a strong chemical signal of hunger.
The researchers discovered that when they prevented the mice's brain cells from nibbling on themselves, a change in the mice's body chemistry occurred. It led mice to become lighter and leaner as they ate less after fasting and burned more energy.
The researchers indicated that understanding exactly how this process works might offer a pathway of intervention for people who struggle to control their appetites.
For more on this subject, come to earthsky.org and search for the word diet. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
With the ever-increasing popularity of the e-reader, many are worried about the decline of the traditional paper book. In an effort to keep the book alive, the nonprofit Little Free Library was born. These little libraries are popping up in towns across the U.S., with some being built right here in Northwest Arkansas. This week, I visited a couple of these local little libraries, as well as spoke with the co-founder of the national organization. Rick Brooks, with Little Free Library in Wisconsin, says the idea came from a friend's memorial to his mother,
who was a teacher, and after she died, he wanted something to remember her by and built a one-room schoolhouse, a little box on a 4x4 post that he put in his front yard. And part of his goal was to actually get people who were driving by to slow down a little bit and see what it was and stop, and he filled it with books. And it was so popular that he called me.
The two installed a little library at a community art gallery in Madison, Wisconsin, along a bike path where thousands of people could see it. A year and a half later, Mr. Brooks says there are little libraries in 23 states and 7 countries.
Just for fun, we want to have more libraries than Andrew Carnegie endowed. And that would be 2,510.
Judith Levine on Park Avenue in Fayetteville has number 0230.
And it's been very cool watching cars pull up and children pop out and open it up and look and take something. And sometimes they go back to the car and rifle through whatever it is that they have and put one back. And sometimes they don't, and that's okay too.
See? The idea behind these little libraries is to take a book, leave a book. Mrs. Levine found out about this movement from Charlie and Allison Allison, who erected the first one in Arkansas in front of their home, located in the historical district in Fayetteville. Mrs. Allison had seen a picture of a friend's on Facebook.
I just thought it would be a great way to bring the neighborhood outdoors and get to know the neighbors better. And I was just obsessed when I saw that picture.
Yeah.
And I just really wanted one for Fayetteville.
As a community builder by occupation, Mr. Brooks says this idea was big in the creation of Little Free Library.
The interest that got us here was really from that standpoint. How do you build a sense of community? And we thought, well, the Little Library seemed to do that quite well. What other messages are you? What other messages can we promote? And those messages are about promoting reading for children, literacy for adults, and libraries around the world.
He says that many of these libraries have themes.
We have one in the dog parks, and it's all about pets and dogs and novels. And, you know, it may have Jack London's White Fang and Harry the Dirty Dog.
Mrs. Levine describes the vision for her library.
For it to be full of children's classics and local authors, if that was at all possible. And in some ways, we've managed to do that. We see we have The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Treasure Island, Sherlock Holmes, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and The Curse of the Campfire Weenies. That's a classic. Lots of Junie B. Jones, Roald Dahl. We have Amy Tan, which I figured was qualifying as a local author, since Molly Giles is her editor and Molly is at the University of Arkansas.
As these libraries recycle books, recycling is also encouraged in the construction of them. Mr. Allison gave me a tour of their library.
It's probably a foot and a half across and maybe 16, 17 inches deep. It's built nearly all with leftover materials or recycled materials that I'd either used for projects in the house or in part of it, it's actually wood that had been taken out of the house and I just kept thinking I would use it someday, and actually I did.
The Allison's library is complete with a gutter system to ensure that the books stay dry in rain. Mrs. Levine, an artist and set designer, constructed her library from recycled materials as well. The only item she had to purchase was the pole to hold it in the ground. And though she only needed 5 feet, the store sent her home with 10.
One of the principles of the Little Free Library movement is pay it forward.
Oh, right.
So I now have the most expensive part in duplicate that I can pay it forward.
The organization has a pay it forward fund. Mr. Brooks provides a recent example of how it works.
When they build one and register, they often contribute $50 to $75 or $100 so that other people can have libraries. And last night, in the middle of the darkness, we delivered a library from the Prairie du Chien prison to a small town of 119 people to the 4-H Club. And they have no library. The closest one is 10 miles away. And this will be posted in a busy intersection in metropolitan Boaz. They will build or raise money to build a library for another town as part of the Pay It Forward Fund, and that's part of the spirit of it.
He mentioned delivery from a prison. To clarify, for people that want a library of their own but aren't as crafty as the Allisons or Levines, one can be purchased from the organization. Furthering the sense of community, those purchased are made by inmates in correctional facilities, or by students in shop classes, or by Amish carpenters. The question can now be raised, how are these little libraries better or different from a traditional public library? Other than just being cute or artistic, Mr. Brooks says the small size serves a purpose.
I'll go into a bookstore and be so overwhelmed that it's just too much. It's more personal, it's more familial, it's neighborhood oriented, and the bottom line, it isn't just the box, it isn't just the books, it's all the things that happen around it. The difference is that there is a place that reminds them that we have things to share.
Books are only one of the things to share. Writing notes in the books left is encouraged. Something that lets the next reader know why you liked the book, what it meant to you. The book donated could also have a meaning. The first book given to the Allison's Library, for example.
The first book that was donated by a dear friend, and it was Drunk with Love, which we thought was appropriate because we're newlyweds.
As mentioned before, the Allisons know the Levines. And the first book donated to the Levines Library came from Mrs. Allison's 14-year-old son. It was immediately borrowed by a little girl from the neighborhood. So if you see a little house in someone's yard, it might not be a birdhouse. So stop and check it out. For information on how to get your own little library or to find one in your area, visit littlefreelibrary.org. And the Allison's Library can be found on Facebook. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday. We're going to play three from Ernest Guitar Roy's new CD, Going Down to Clarksdale. He'll be in Fayetteville next Friday night, February 10th. We also have new stuff from Sherry Williams, Harrison Kennedy, Joe Lewis Walker, Adam Gousseau, and a few others. And that's the Generic Blue Show every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
It's Friday, February 3rd, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining us now is Becca Bacon-Martin, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So this weekend, it's pretty much music, comedy, or theater.
Okay.
With the exception of Bring It On, the musical, which combines music, comedy, and theater with cheerleading.
I'm very excited about this. I'm not even kidding. I'm going.
I'm kind of confused about the whole concept.
Really?
I've seen the movie, the first movie.
Yes.
But apparently, this is a Tony Award-winning writer, the guy who wrote Avenue Q, a Tony Award-winning composer who did The Heights, a Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning composer who did Next to Normal, and a lyricist who did High Fidelity. That's a pretty amazing production team.
Right. And the guy from Avenue Q, is that the guy that's from Fayetteville?
The guy who wrote Avenue Q.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay. And then In the Heights is going to be here later in March.
But there's a guy from Bentonville in this show.
Yes.
So that's exciting. His name's Sheldon Tucker, and he graduated from Bentonville High School and did Roger's Little Theater shows and was cheering collegiately in Hawaii when he was recruited for this show.
Because there are people that do actual gymnastic stunts in it.
Right. The premise, in case you wondered or needed a premise, is that there are two squads, two schools, and one mission to claim the title at the National Cheerleading Championships.
Is it my understanding that it's not like the same characters and everything from the movie, but it sounds kind of like a similar storyline?
Right.
Okay.
Right. It starts tonight at the Walton Art, or Tuesday night,
Tuesday
rather.
Night. Mm-hmm.
I'm jumping the gun. Sorry, don't cheer there. 7 o'clock Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, 8 o'clock Friday, 2 and 8 Saturday, and 2 and 7:30 Sunday of next weekend at Walton Art Center. Tickets start at $49. Now, if you want just traditional theater, we're going to break out the elements here.
Yes.
Dial M for Murder is on stage at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 1952 thriller set in London, and it revolves around a former tennis pro named Tony who married his wife Margot for money, and he's about to commit murder to keep it.
Sounds like a great hubby.
Yeah, it's fun. It's in the vein of Agatha Christie and all those popular shows. 7:30 tonight and tomorrow night, 3 o'clock Sunday, and again next Friday and Saturday at ACO in Springdale. Tickets are $20 for adults, and then there's comedy.
Okay.
Kansas City comic Mike Baldwin, coming to the UARC Bowl on Sunday evening. He told one of our reporters, Ashley Batchelor, "I just joke about the things that I see. I just say things and people laugh at them."
I can relate to this.
Which is pretty much everyone we know, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He won the 2011 Seattle International Comedy Competition and the 2011 Trial by Laughter in Indianapolis, and his debut album called Bees Can Taste With Their Feet reached number 8 on the iTunes U.S. Comedy Charts. His show's at 7:30 Sunday at the York Bowl, and tickets are $7 for adults. And then there's music.
Okay.
Stacey Earle and Mark Stewart are back at Good Folk tonight.
Hmm.
They've had a couple of solo albums, but they're back on the road as a duo, and admission to tonight's show is $15, 7:30 showtime, and you should call for reservations because Good Folk is tiny.
And it sells out really quickly.
521-1812. And Joy DeFrancesco is coming to Legacy Blues tonight with his Hammond organ.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm told that it is sold out, but you can call for a wait list. 587-8981. And then on Wednesday and Thursday of next week, Ray Wiley Hubbard comes to Arkansas.
Where?
He is at Second Street Live in Fort Smith on Wednesday and at George's on Thursday. And you can check out Kevin Kinder's music blog at nwatunedin.com for all about that stuff.
Perfect. So I suppose you are choosing theater?
I suppose I'm choosing to unpack boxes.
Oh, that's right. Moving.
Yeah, moving. I hope to come back to the land of the fun and living in time for the Theater Squared show next weekend.
Well, it runs until March, so you have time.
Oh, please God, yes.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hello, this is Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday night from 10 till midnight. On this week's show, we'll hear music from guitarist Russell Malone, trumpeter Arturo Sandoval, and we'll also hear from Tia Fuller, Brad Meldow, and much more. I hope you'll tune in this Friday for Shades of Jazz.
KUAF is supported by RLT, which continues its 26th main stage season with the musical Hairspray. It begins Friday, February 10th and runs through the 26th. In this production, a lovable plus-size heroine finds herself transformed from an outsider to teen celebrity overnight. 631-8988 or rogerslittletheater.org for tickets or more information. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. On February 12th, the Walden Arts Center will host a countdown conversation at the Fayetteville Public Library about world drumming traditions in preparation of Tao, the Art of the Drum. The event is part of the Art Center's 10x10 series. The next performance in the series is tonight and will feature the musical trio Time for Three. Ozarks at Large's Katie Henriksen recently spoke to a member of the group about their passions both on and off the stage.
The genre-defying trio Time for Three, featuring Zachary Depew violin, Nicholas Kendall violin, and Renan Mayer double bass, are at the Walden Arts Center tonight to give a performance as a part of the 10x10 series. The three are all classically trained musicians who met at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, but their music transcends classification, blending elements of classical, country western, gypsy, jazz, and indie rock. In addition to being passionate about the music they play, they are passionate about reaching out to kids and empowering them through music. When they arrived in Northwest Arkansas yesterday, they spent time at Bentonville High School, where they spoke to over 550 students in the visual performing arts community about their careers, their passion, and to demonstrate their music and speak about anti-bullying. Today, they're doing the same at Rogers High School. When I spoke with bassist Renan Mayer earlier in the week, we talked about the music, but we also talked about this mission statement and why it was so important to the group.
Well, the reason that, well, gosh, the reasons why we do that, it keeps on blossoming, to tell you the truth. It started out where, you know, we just were blown away that we were in a position in our lives to, you know, to inspire young musicians and young people. And so that was the first draw for us to do it. And then over the years, we've realized that we're not bad at it, because of a couple of reasons. We speak the language of sort of just normal people. And we also happen to play instruments that, sometimes are viewed as abnormal, you know, to the bulk of society. Not that people haven't heard of a violin, or a bass, but it's sort of just not, you know, it's not your common thread, you know, like a guitar and drums and bass guitar and all that stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But we realized we're sort of able to, put out an image that is very, very normal and very much so something that people who play like the rock band stuff, you know, like those instruments that I was just talking about, are sort of like, you know. So that's one thing. The other thing to go along with that is that we, we want to make people feel that they know that it's okay to be themselves and to follow their dreams as long as it's not hurting anybody else. It's great for us to inspire other young musicians to go be professional musicians, and that's wonderful. But, you know, what it comes down to is the odds are against them. And that doesn't mean that they can't do it, but that means that it's challenged because of the numbers. But as far as people following their dreams and doing what they love to do, we feel like that's a very possible thing. And what we try to do is spread that message to young people so they can understand how rewarding it is for us in our lives to do what it is we love. And as long as it isn't hurting anybody, as long as it's ethical, that they should follow their dreams as well. And that's our big, big, big message. We have another message that also has to do with, anti-bullying, that goes along with this empowerment message, which is, you know, to let them know that, you know, hey, you know, Time for Three looks all cool now, but, back in the day, believe it or not, you know, each one of these guys on stage were made fun of and bullied at least a little bit at times for playing this instrument, you know, for playing the instrument you see in front of you. And, you know, we feel that relates to some of these kids that we're playing to, if not all of them, that maybe they experienced that for whatever it is they do or for whatever it is they like, they've been made fun of. Sometimes it's very, very basic where you've been made fun of, like maybe your older brother says, oh, you're stupid for doing that. You're stupid for reading that book. Why do you want to read that book? Oh, you're stupid for playing the bassoon. Why are you playing the bassoon? Things like that. And so, and other times, you know, seven kids get around this bassoon player in a circle and they beat the bassoon player up because they think that that's the cool thing to do. And so we're trying to say, you know, hey, you know, stick to your guns, stick to what you love. Do this because at the end of the day, you're going to be the one that's celebrating. And that's really the message that we want to share to the younger generation, just so they know that at the end of all of this, there's just such love and fulfillment and joy for following, you know, your dreams. So that's the message, and that's the reason why we do it. You know, there are these horrible stories about, this poor kid in Rutgers who, was undercovered for being, you know, for being gay, and he ended up committing suicide.
Mm-hmm.
It's just awful, you know, that people, you know, end up having to do awful things to others, and then the consequences can be, you know, that extreme. You know, the other side of the argument from which Time for Three sort of jokes about at times, it's no joke, but we sort of tease each other about is, you know, we were bullied, but we all landed on our feet. So there's one other viewpoint where it's like, well, you know, a little bit of bullying might go a long way. You know, it actually sometimes makes you tougher and all that stuff. And that's true. But that said, I think there are other ways to go about it than, you know, than bullying. And there's enough natural bullying that's going to take place that if everybody, you know, holds their hands and gets together and sings Kumbaya, which Arlo Guthrie talks about all the time, I think we really can prevent a lot of these really drastic things that happen as a result of, you know, young people just not knowing that something is wrong.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think, what makes music unique, like a unique way to reach out to kids and connect with them?
Because music has the ability to widen the senses and to pull the emotions out of people in a way that's unique and special comparatively to just your everyday ant work. You know, with music, you know, we're able to make an entire audience feel. To listen, to sit down, to listen, and to feel. And even a room of sixth graders, even middle schoolers, will be able to spend 5 minutes not being middle schoolers, just being people and feeling from our music. And at that point, we're able to not just conceptualize, but really get down to the core of what it is that's going on, and then to talk to them after that point. So it's powerful because it's not just a lecture up there. You know, we're up there, we're doing what we love. We're exposing them to feeling happy, to crying, to feeling angry, to feeling a story through our music. And then after the music's done, we're able to communicate a message based on what's happened.
Time for Three bassist Renan Mayer about why educating kids and empowering them through music is so important. The trio performs tonight at the Walton Arts Center. Tickets are still available by calling 443-5600 or by visiting the box office online at waltonartscenter.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
Time for Three will perform at 8 o'clock tonight at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. More information is available at waltonartscenter.org. Earlier today, the trio stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio. The musicians played a few songs for us, and we will share that live performance with you next week on Ozarks at Large.
Many Fridays, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talks with our resident math professor, Chaim Goodman Strauss. This week, they sat down to talk about numbers, words, baseball, and polar bears.
We had a puzzle last week, but some things to take care of before then?
Sure. Well, you know, as many people are aware, this is the year 2012.
I would hope that most of our listeners are aware
and
of that.
And we've been asking, what is interesting about the year 2012? And Jeff Yoke, who is a longtime Math Factor correspondent, points out that perhaps 2012 is the least interesting year.
Really?
Wouldn't that be cool? Actually, I have to say, if it is truly an uninteresting year in history, that would be a real blessing for all of us, wouldn't it?
You know,
It seems like the trouble usually happens in the interesting years. But that raises an interesting, of course, he's really pointing out a paradox. If it were truly the least interesting year,
it'd be interesting because it was the least interesting.
That's right. So what's the least interesting number, folks? Well,
Is there a least interesting?
That's, of course, the paradox,
right?
But here's a couple of others. That reminds me of self-descriptive adjectives are pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Like short is a short adjective.
And
We.
W-E-E, we. That's a good one.
Polysyllabic.
Is
multisyllabic.
Right, but then the inverse of that.
Monosyllabic is not self-descriptive. Right, so that's pretty cool. Neither is long. Long is not a long adjective. Crunchy is not a crunchy ad. That doesn't even make sense.
Right.
It's like one of those bad Mad Libs. Awkwardnessful is a favorite.
awkwardnessful? Is that a real word?
Well, I don't know. But Douglas Hofstadter, who wrote a lot about this stuff, fantastic author. That was one of his inventions, awkwardnessful. And of course, awkwardnessful is awkwardnessful.
Right. It's just tough to say.
So here's one, non-self-descriptive.
Okay.
Is that?
Oh, wait. Non-self-descriptive means that it isn't.
Would not describe itself.
Well, so. But. Therefore.
Yeah, well, like, yeah, okay. Right, exactly.
Okay, I see where you're going.
It's, I don't know if we'll pick up on that again, but.
All right, last time we were together, you had kind of a puzzle for us that involved three professors and a student. And the professors were trying to catch up with the student.
Right. In the original incarnation of the problem, it's three spiders and a fly, but we were having a little fun.
Sure. And the grid that all of our actors are on, the three professors or predators and the student or the potential prey.
Let's draw it out.
Okay. So if I have a square.
Draw a square.
Okay. There it is.
And now draw one diagonal from one corner to the other.
Right.
And now draw another diagonal, but the two diagonals don't really, I mean, they cross, but they kind of don't really meet, so to speak.
Right.
You can stay on one diagonal or the other, but you can't switch in the middle.
Gotcha. There's not a true intersection there.
That's right.
All right. So what we have is a square with more or less an X in the middle.
Right. And so now the three predators, so to speak, are running around that thing. And they're a little bit faster than the prey.
Right.
That's the only thing. And so the question is how can the predators catch the prey?
Exactly. And so there is a design?
Sure. If the prey stays on the square.
That is the outer border.
Border. Then it's clear that one of the predators can just chase it down eventually.
Well, you're
moving a little fast. No, it just goes around.
Oh,
Right? Just chases it. The prey can't elude. By the way, the prey knows exactly where the predators are, so it's not like it can.
You can lay in wait.
Right. But if it's running around the square, the predator just chases it down. So it has to go into the middle somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the other thing. So one spider's running around the outside.
Taking care of that.
And then one spider's on one diagonal, one spider's on the other.
Oh.
And then you just, a little bit of a timing issue to make sure. But see, if the thing goes up on a diagonal and comes back down, avoiding the spider on the diagonal, it just wastes time, so it's even easier to catch.
So eventually.
Yeah, so that's all there is.
Okay. Hey, guess what? I have a puzzle.
You do?
I do.
Wow, Kyle, 8 years on the air.
And yes.
Tables are turned.
Okay.
Lay it on me.
And this is this is not a hypothetical puzzle.
Oh, no.
This is.
Lives are at stake?
No. Okay. No. This is something that really happened.
Okay.
It involves baseball, but you don't have to know anything about baseball or statistics or even the rules.
Okay.
All right?
Are we answering it today or are we going to leave it as a puzzle?
I think we'll let mine.
Same routine. Okay.
Okay. So.
So I don't have to know.
No, you can think about this. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And I'm going to give you four or five facts.
Okay.
And you will have all the information you need to know.
Okay.
To come up with the answer.
All right. I got a pencil. Just.
From 1968 to 1976, there was an outfielder in Major League Baseball named Carlos May.
Mm-hmm.
His second year in the major leagues, he asked for uniform number 17 and received it.
Okay.
And thus, he became the only Major League Baseball player in history to have accomplished something. That's all you need to know.
Really?
Yep.
No way.
He was an outfielder.
Uh-huh.
I should tell you he played for Chicago. So let me put that.
I need to know that, or they're just messing with me?
Okay. I'm going to give you, let's say there are five facts.
Okay.
Carlos May played for 8 years. He was an outfielder. Most of the time he played for the Chicago White Sox.
Uh-huh.
And he asked for uniform number 17 his second year and received it.
Wow.
There you go.
Now I know how you feel. I have no idea what to
And you don't have to know
about.
Anything. It has nothing to do with the most this or the fastest that. Everything is right there.
You got me stumped.
Okay. Well, we'll answer that. Now, you've got a puzzle this week, too.
I do. Well,
two puzzles for one show.
Wow. You know, I thought we'd revisit some old goodies, oldies, but very good puzzles. So I'm sure we did these on the radio before the podcast started, but that was even then, eight years ago.
Yes.
And this is actually the first puzzle that our great hero, Martin Gardner, ever published in Scientific American.
In case someone doesn't know who Martin Gardner was, he is seen as the grandfather of published mathematical puzzles.
Oh, yeah. Well,
of the modern age.
Of the modern age, right.
I mean, throwing out Copernicus or Newton or people
like
that.
Well, there's Sam Lloyd from about 100 odd years ago.
Well, I'm saying in the post-Lloyd period.
Okay. Okay, so he in one of his very first column of mathematical games, which ended up running for a quarter century in Scientific American.
Mm-hmm. Had, very popular.
Very
column.
Popular. Had nine puzzles, and I think I'll read the first of the nine. So
let's
this
do
technically
that. So this is technically the first Martin Gardner puzzle that was ever published in Scientific American.
That's right. Well, so you know, you've probably heard the puzzle about an explorer walks 1 mile south. Mm-hmm. He turns and walks 1 mile east and then 1 mile north. He's on exactly the spot where he started somehow. Shoots a bear, what color is the bear? So there's some spot on the earth that you can walk 1 mile south, 1 mile east, 1 mile north, and end up exactly where you started. And so where's that? And then he shoots a bear there just to kind of, and what color is the bear? So really, if you know where he is, then you can.
Do you want me to answer this now?
Sure, yeah.
I'm assuming the bear is white.
It is.
Because he's at the top of the world.
That's
there.
Exactly right.
So you. So it's a polar bear that he shot.
A polar bear.
Right.
So you come down from the North Pole.
Which is illegal, by the way.
Okay, but here's the thing. There's actually not only – there's actually another spot on the Earth you can do that. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's infinitely many other spots that work.
So the question is, where can you walk 1 mile south, mm-hmm. then 1 mile
east,
then 1 mile
north
and you're back where you started.
Right, and there may or may not be bears involved.
Okay, but where can you do that?
Right.
All right, so people can think about that. And about Carlos May?
Yeah, all of it.
All right.
MathFactor@uark.edu, MathFactor.uark.edu, and see you later.
Thanks, Haim.
Thank you.
Haim Goodman-Strauss is a math professor at the University of Arkansas. He talks with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums most Fridays.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 3rd of February, 2012. It's the birthday of the novelist James A. Michener, born in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, 1907, author of Tales of the South Pacific and many other books, who said, "I'm not a very good writer, but I'm an excellent rewriter." It's the birthday of Gertrude Stein, born in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, 1874. She was 30 years old when she moved to Paris, and she lived there for almost the rest of her life. She lived in a house with paintings by Cézanne, Picasso, Renoir, Gauguin, and others, which became known as a great salon. Writers and artists came. Ernest Hemingway once said of her, "Gertrude was always right." She once said, "America is my country, and Paris is my hometown." And it's the birthday of the novelist Paul Auster, born in Newark, New Jersey, 1947, who said, "Becoming a writer is not a career decision. You don't choose it so much as get chosen. And once you accept the fact that you're not fit for anything else, you have to be prepared to walk a long, hard road for the rest of your days." Paul Auster, author of the New York Trilogy and other novels. Here's a poem for today by George Bilgear entitled Grecian Temples. "Because I'm getting pretty gray at the temples, which negatively impacts my earning potential and does not necessarily attract vibrant young women with their perfumed bosoms to dally with me on the green hillside, I go out and buy some Grecian hair formula. And after the whole process, which involves rubber gloves, a tiny chemistry set, and perfect timing, I look great. I look very fresh and virile, full of earning potential. But when I take my 15-year-old beagle out for his evening walk, the contrast is unfortunate. Next to me, he doesn't look all that great, with his graying snout, his sort of faded, worn-out dog look. It makes me feel old, walking around with a dog like that. It's not something a potential employer, much less a vibrant young woman with a perfumed bosom, would necessarily go for. So I go out and get some more Grecian hair formula, light brown, my beagle's original color. And after all the rigmarole, he looks terrific. I mean, he's not going to win any friskiness contests, not at 15, but there's a definite visual improvement. The two of us walk virilely around the block. The next day, a striking young woman at the bookstore happens to ask me about my parents, who are, in fact, long dead due to the effects of age. They were very old, which causes death. But having dead old parents does not go with my virile, intensely fresh,
new look. So I say to the woman, my parents are fine. They love their active lifestyle in San Diego. You know, windsurfing, high alai, a still vibrant sex life. And while this does not necessarily cause her to come dally with me on the green hillside, I can tell it doesn't exactly hurt my chances. I can see her imagining dinner with my sparkly, young-seeming mom and dad at some beachside restaurant where we would announce our engagement. Your son has great earning potential, she'd say to Dad, who would take a gander at her perfumed bosom and give me a wink like he used to do back when he was alive and vibrant. Grecian Temples, a poem by George Bilgear from The White Museum, published by Autumn House Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Spring's first foot race of the year dashes along the challenging course at Lake Leatherwood. It's next Saturday, February 11th at 10 a.m. The race takes place in any weather and along the same course every year. The proceeds from the 2012 race will benefit the University of Arkansas Cycling Club. Participants may register at active.com or in person at Fleet Feet in Fayetteville. For cost or more information, call 479-571-8786.
The folk duo Still on the Hill will perform a concert of all love songs to mark the release of their new CD, Red Curtain, on Valentine's Day, February 14th, at Good Folk in Fayetteville. There will be a social hour before the show, starting at 7 p.m. Special guests include Walter Savage and Jack Williams. Reservations are requested and can be made at 521-1812 or goodfolk.org. Still on the Hill will be in the studio next week, and we will bring that to you, I think, Wednesday on Ozarks at Large.
All right. The Washington County Library System will begin hosting interactive storytime activities for children 3 and up February 6th and running through mid-May. The series of programs, titled Rocky's Pet Shop, will feature stories about animals. It's free and registration is not required. For participating libraries and dates, call 479-422-6253.
KUAF is supported by Fayetteville Athletic Club, offering a network of support, information, and guidance to help achieve fitness goals and aspirations for individuals, friends, and families. Information regarding fitness training, weight loss, healthy living, and more is available at fayac.com or 587-0500.
A listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Rogers, Fayetteville, Springdale, and Goshen.
There you go. You do anything this weekend?
Not really.
Not really?
Yeah, no, nothing. Nothing
Super Bowl?
Exciting. Possibly.
Are you
eating,
big
eating good?
Fan?
No, I'm not a football fan. I didn't even know who was playing until this Wednesday, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not really either. I am more a fan of the commercials and the food
that people make.
Are you going to make anything? Because you're good at making snacks.
Maybe. Yeah. I really want some nachos.
Oh, that sounds
good. For some
good.
Reason, I want some like nice nachos.
Like just loaded with everything
yes.
on them.
Yes.
So do you have to cheer for a team? Like when you hang out with your friends, do you have to pick a side? Does anybody care?
No, not really.
Not really. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not me either.
Yeah.
So not big football fans, but for those of you that are, we hope you enjoy this weekend. Let's see. Sunday at 9, we have Weekend Ozarks at Large with Ithi Agnihotri-Madolkar and Kyle Kellums. And then I will be back on Monday. All right. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Have a good weekend.
Happy Friday.